with an apology. And my apology is that I had so much fun putting this presentation together that I put way too much information in to complete in a 20-minute period of time. But there are several pieces of information in the document that I think might be helpful to you, even if I don't have time to dwell on them in presentations. So I'm going to pass my business card out, and if any of you would like a copy of the presentation, I'll be happy to email it to you. So
you may do that.
If you don't mind doing that. So I'm going to start, let's see here if I can figure out which buttons to push. There we go. This is an outline of my presentation. I'm going to give you mostly a pictorial, historical overview of migrant farm workers in the United States. We're going to talk a little bit about navigating the healthcare system in the United States from the perspective of a patient, and I hope that this will segue very nicely into what my colleague Dr. Rios will present to you about the Mexican healthcare system, because for folks coming from Mexico's system to our system, sometimes ours is totally unnavigable. I want to talk about access barriers in the United States, and that's where I will talk about Medicaid. And then I'm going to give you a very quick overview of community migrant health centers in the U.S. If we run out of time, that last section is probably the section that we could pass on. But my question to you is, do you all know about migrant and community health centers? If you could raise your hand if you do. Okay, so three out of nine. Okay, well, I'll try and cover that one then. So I'm going to just start real briefly with the historical perspective of agricultural migration to and in the United States in the 20th century. 1917, Immigration and Nationality Act, 73,000 Mexicans migrate to the U.S. The Dust Bowl, of course, we all know about the displaced farm workers and sharecroppers, which began the phenomenon of domestic agricultural migration. And then in 1942, the signing of the Bracero Treaty, which was the Mexican contribution to the Allied war effort. Our farm boys went overseas, and we had no one to harvest our crops. In 1951, Public Law 78 reauthorized the Bracero Treaty. Now, you have to think about that for a minute. This was a World War II effort to provide agricultural laborers while our farm boys were in the European war theater. But in 1951, we reauthorized it, well after the end of the war. In 1952, the establishment of the H-2 program was formed, very similar to the Bracero Treaty, but requiring a certificate on the part of the employer verifying that domestic workers are not available. Today, the 2008 the H-2 program continues in full force, and the date that's missing here is the date that the Bracero Treaty was repealed, and I believe that was 1964. So between 1951 and 1964, well past the end of World War II, we continued to import Mexican labor to work in agriculture. And I think that that's very, very poignant, and I feel armed with great information with that fact, because it is important for some of our more narrow-minded citizenry in this country to understand that Mexicans are not interlopers who come to our country, but in fact, these are people who were our allies and who bailed us out when we needed help. And it should not come as any surprise to anyone that circuits of travel and family linkages have been established over all of those decades. My organization, the National Center for Farmworker Health, and you'll see these up close in a minute, so don't strain your eyes, has been the beneficiary of a huge collection of materials that came from one woman. Her name was Helen Johnston, and Helen worked for the Migrant Health Unit, which I'll talk about a little bit in a little bit later. And we have been slowly culling through these 52 large paper ream boxes to pull information out. And this is the this is the information I want to share with you about the history of the Bracero Act. I have a woman on my staff whose father was a Bracero, is still alive today. Her siblings are spaced 2 years apart because he came and went back every 2 years. And every time she looks at this picture of Mexicans on the border waiting to enter the U.S., she looks for her father's face. Once they got into the United States, the registration lines formed. The process began. This is not a family unit. It's just that it's easier to take pictures four at a time than one at a time. Fingerprinting, vaccinations, physical exams and x-rays. I think about the Holocaust when I see this picture. Preparing the contract, and every worker that entered the United States had a contract hand-typed by these young ladies, and that contract withheld 10% of their wages that was held by the U.S. government and was to be sent back to the Mexican government in their name at the end of their tour of duty in the United States, and this was to be the financial incentive for them to go home when we didn't need them anymore. And the U.S. government did not make good on that promise. It wasn't the Mexican government that failed, it was the U.S. government. And in spite of the fact that the statute of limitations had run out on those contracts, recent lawsuits against the United States have begun the process of refunding that money to braceros and their family members, and then waiting for work. And I'm always quite moved when I see those photographs and wanted to share those with you. The records that we have through 1949 show these numbers of workers coming across the border. And this map was undated in the collection that we have, but we believe it from the materials that were accompanying it that it comes from the early 1940s. And this shows the areas of concentration of agricultural migrants in the United States at that time. And then we have today's farm workers, and these photographs have been taken by a colleague of ours and a photographer by the name of Alan Pogue, who is an Austin-based photographer. Yes, we have lots of single males. We have elderly people who come both to work and to support their family members. We have family units of all shapes and sizes. The majority of these people that were taken in this collection were actually from South Texas. Child labor is still an issue today. And we have farm workers who come to us from deep in Mexico, where they're not speaking either Spanish or English, but we also have farm workers who come to us from Haiti. And this woman comes from Laos. She's in New Jersey picking blueberries. This is kind of a bridge slide. A lot of times, and sometimes out of ignorance or perhaps habit, people tend to use these terms interchangeably. And I think that you can read this faster than I can talk it to you, but the point of this slide is to say that the terms immigrant and emigrant and migrante and migrant are not interchangeable. They don't mean exactly the same thing, even though we tend to use them very casually. For purposes of this presentation, when I say migrant, I'm referring to an agricultural worker who makes a migratory circuit in order to work in agriculture. And it doesn't matter whether they come from Texas or Florida or California or Mexico or Central America. That, to me, is the word I will use to refer to an agricultural worker who migrates. However, I think in the grander scheme of global migration, especially with our neighboring country, Mexico, we're going to use the term migrante to talk about the large population, estimated to be as high as 20 million migrantes, who come from Mexico to the United States to work in a variety of occupations, everything from domestic to construction to landscaping and on and on. Migrant characteristics in terms of mobility. And then in Mexico, you'll hear about a program, I hope, called Vete Sano, Regrese Sano. And that is largely a domestic Mexican project that helps to prepare people for migration both within Mexico and as they leave Mexico to come to the United States. But the question is, how can they come back healthy? Vete sano means go healthy. Regrese sano means come back healthy. How can they come back healthy without a healthcare safety net in the United States? And while we do have a migrant health program and a community health center program, we don't really have a strong immigrant health program in the United States, at least at the federal level. So our proposal is that we help to maintain health, that we want them to arrive healthy. And we do have some very, very healthy individuals and families that come. As you may know, for example, birth outcomes among recent immigrants are usually quite positive, whereas second, third generation, the birth outcomes deteriorate. So from the perspective of a patient navigating the U.S. healthcare system, for the general population, such as you and I have very good insurance, medical insurance, I still find isolated islands of care. It's hard to establish a medical home. Limited focus on prevention services, fragmentation of services, Think about when people are hospitalized in particular, but also with primary care. Lack of inter and intra-institutional coordination, record-keeping, manual versus electronic medical records versus electronic health records. And I emphasize that because the difference between the EMR and the EHR is who owns the record. With an EHR, the patient owns the record. With an EMR, the institution owns the record and therefore is not portable. The high cost of premiums, copays, deductibles, specialty care, and pharmacy. I was just telling Enrique that my 5-year-old grandson, who is on my insurance policy, has asthma, and he takes 7 medications. And even with really great medical insurance, those medications cost me on average $45 each per month. So you can imagine that for a family with limited income and no medical insurance to cover the copay or the prescription itself, that can be very, very daunting. And as far as other goes, I suspect that you in public health have full knowledge of the additional barriers, challenges that folks face. I'd like to give you some quotes here from a publication called Mending Texas's Fractured Healthcare System. It's a primary care coalition, and it's dated 2008. In the absence of a health delivery system that supports cost-effective, coordinated, high-quality health care for patients, a fractured system has evolved that provides inefficient and expensive care to those who can afford it and allows those less fortunate to fall between the cracks. The United States spends 16% of its gross domestic product on health care, $7,600 a year for each person, yet nearly 47 million are uninsured. Children receive only 47% of recommended care overall and just 41% of the preventive services that they need. Only 39% of Texas adults age 50 or older received recommended screening and preventive care in 2004, and 10% of the population account for 70% of health care expenditures. The healthier 50% of the population consumes only 3% of health care expenditures. I think that those facts, while they apply primarily to Texas, and I think that the Texas system could arguably be among the worst in the nation, apply very, very well to the population that we're talking about. And in fact, their situation is significantly worse. So general population immigrants for migrantes, that includes migrants and migrantes. We're talking about recent immigrants from Mexico and Central America, from landless, rural, poor families, a young, youthful population, historically mostly male, a recent rise in the numbers of young females that are coming, especially from the indigenous communities in Mexico, poorly educated, may not be literate in or even speak Spanish, and limited English proficiency, many of whom are undocumented. The farm worker migration today, we have increasing numbers of H-2A workers, the A being the agricultural designation of today's immigration policy and procedure. More males traveling alone, fewer families traveling together, more workers establishing themselves in rural communities as seasonal workers, less trans-border migration because of the perception that we have terrorists among our agricultural worker population. And if you can think of our terrorists out toiling in the fields and where that takes your imagination. There are more of our migrants and migrantes now working in other industries such as construction, meat processing, and dairy during the non-agricultural season. Access barriers in the United States. How am I doing on time? Okay, go. I can slow down a little bit then. Okay. Access barriers in the United States. This is what we know from our frontline work with the community and migrant health centers that we support. And it has to do not only with how migrantes feel in our community health centers, but in general how they feel in the communities where they live and work, sometimes trying to access institutions and private practices. They often feel unwelcome in the provider's office, their mobility in terms of continuity of care, the fact that there is no paid sick time, which means that when they take time off from work, they don't get paid, which is slightly different from the fact that they also work in leave it and lose it types of jobs, For some of them, if they take that day off to go to the doctor, it may mean that when they come back, they have no job. So it's worse than just not getting paid. Lack of health insurance, limited knowledge of the system, not knowing where to go, limited income resources, lack of transportation. We're talking both in rural and urban communities. Language limitations, varying levels of literacy, and limited level of health literacy. You're all public health people. I don't need to emphasize for you the difference between literacy and health literacy, but those are two very distinct and yet very, very important issues. Cultural and fear issues, and then no continuity of history and treatment. There are also institutional access barriers. The high cost of health care in the United States, and we all know about that, right? Uninsured patients pay higher prices because they don't have access to network discounts. Limited points of access for primary care. Location and operating hours of those points of access. If you have a leave it or lose it type of job and you need to go to the doctor, sometimes those private offices or even community health centers are not open at hours that are convenient for you. And unfortunately, that often ends up in with the patient accessing the emergency room. So while they might be able to pay a $30 copay at a community health center or even a $100 fee in a private practitioner's office, there's no way that they're going to be able to pay the exorbitant fee of the emergency room. So that creates vulnerabilities for our communities because of uncompensated care. The location and operating hours of primary care access points, closed or limited practices where providers are not accepting new patients or not accepting patients that have Medicaid or Medicare or not accepting patients who have no insurance. Lack of transportation systems, particularly in the rural areas. And then English is the dominant language in the institution with no interpreters. And when I first started working in migrant health, the hospital that our clinic delivered their babies at was a hospital that had the practice of bringing the Hispanic custodian up from the basement to translate for the pregnant women. And we do now have cultural, linguistic acceptability standards in the United States that are promulgated by HRSA, Health Resources and Services Administration, that mandate that any provider that takes $1 of federal money, that means even private practitioners who accept Medicaid or Medicare or CHIP, must provide culturally and linguistically acceptable care. That doesn't happen, and that rule is not well enforced. And then waiting period for appointments. We operate on an appointment system in this country, and sometimes when you have patients who put off care because they're trying to earn enough money to put food on the table and keep a roof over the heads of their families, making an appointment becomes a huge barrier, and our private practitioners don't always have triage systems. This is where I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Medicaid, and that's the last item on the bottom. I want to do justice to that since it was such an important part of the title of this workshop. But I'm going to start by talking about commercial insurance. It is seldom provided by employers of this population that we're talking about. We do begin to see in California the provision of some insurance for agricultural workers who work here on a seasonal basis and have been employed for many, many years with one employer. But for the most part, our migrantes are not working in the types of industry that provide employer-paid insurance. When that happens, they face the same thing that you and I do, and that is that there are copays for the premiums and copays for the office visits, copays for the pharmaceutical prescriptions, copays for lab, x-ray, and any additional work that needs to be done on an outpatient basis, not to mention copays for hospitalization. For migrantes, these copays alone are prohibitive. Specialty care access, providers often demanding payment in advance, and then the simple fact that we have limited access to specialty providers in the rural areas. Community and Migrant Health Center program, which is the field that I work in largely and I uphold and will talk to you more about them very shortly, Unfortunately, we still have geographic gaps in the availability of the community and migrant health centers. And in all cases, we have greater demand at the front door, at the front reception area, than we have availability and capacity to serve. Then there's CHIP and Medicaid and Medicare. As you know, these programs are largely for residents only, and while exceptions to this do exist in states like New York and Washington State, by and large, the poorer states in the United States are very rigorous about how they enforce the eligibility for Medicaid, CHIP, and Medicare. Our states do have emergency Medicaid programs, and that's a good thing to know about if you don't know about it. Does everybody know about emergency Medicaid? I'm seeing a few heads nod. Emergency Medicaid, if you have a true emergency and are hospitalized, the way for the hospital to make sure that they get their reimbursement is that the social worker goes to the patient in their room and helps them to apply for emergency Medicaid. So whether they are a single male without a family or whether they are documented or not, those people often can qualify for emergency Medicaid, which will help to provide them with safety net services for true emergencies. But it has to be an emergency. And I'll give you an example of a patient that we have worked with for many years, who is an undocumented solo male in Southern California, by the way, who has had kidney failure. And it had been recommended that he have dialysis on a regular basis, but because ongoing dialysis is not an emergency, it was not covered by emergency Medicaid. And so his practice was to wait until he literally started to turn yellow and go into the emergency room. We worked with a number of providers in the area and were able to get him on, and now my recollection fails me, we were able to get him on a type of dialysis machine that he could do at home, very lengthy, very cumbersome, but something that he could do at home. I've lost the term. I apologize. But they're thank you very much. Thank you. My roots as an administrator are showing through. Thank you. And then, of course, the problem with Medicaid for those people who are eligible, or CHIP, who are eligible, is that it is not portable from state to state like Medicare is. So with Medicaid and CHIP, could I get a little bit of water? With Medicaid and CHIP, we know that the program is a federal program and it's administered by individual states, with states contributing to the financial cost of administering that program. And what we find is that the eligibility criteria and the enrollment criteria vary greatly from state to state. Some states you have to be at or below 100% of poverty. Some states you can be as high as 200% of poverty in order to qualify for Medicaid and for CHIP. The payment of CHIP monthly premiums is very, very cumbersome to a migrating or immigrant population who has to make monthly payments. And in fact, the vast majority of our migrantes do not qualify for CHIP because their income levels fall below the CHIP eligibility criteria. The other thing that we run into with those who are residents and eligible for CHIP or Medicaid is that often the parents are not. They're undocumented. The children are, because they're born in the United States. And even within family units, children are eligible for different programs based on when and where they're born. And so a family may have two children on Medicaid and three children on CHIP, or one child on CHIP. And each of those programs have different benefits, different costs, and different payment mechanisms. And then, God forbid, they should move out of state. And up until recently, that they should move around within the state, because California is a prime example of where Medicaid was actually administered on a county-by-county basis. So if you moved from one county to the next, you had to disenroll and re-enroll. Excuse me. There is significant variance in provider payment rates. Texas has just recently raised the rates of payment or reimbursement to private providers in the state of Texas, and it has been among the worst in the nation. Other states tend to reimburse at a higher rate. that creates disincentives for providers to participate in the CHIP and the Medicaid programs, because if their reimbursement is $35 and the cost of the care was $100, they're not even covering the cost of their staff to provide that service, let alone the provider's time. Mixed family resident status, I've already touched on that one. Varying presumptive eligibility policies from one state to the next. In some states, if a pregnant woman shows up at a provider's office, they will, and she has no insurance and is low income, they can enroll her and presume eligibility and begin the treatment of prenatal care until such time as the eligibility process has been completed. And there's an assurance that the provider will receive payment for those services provided under presumed eligibility. But that's not the case. It's allowed by federal law, but it's not put into practice in all states. And then lastly, that there is no interstate portability or reciprocity. So what that means is that if I were to be able to go back to that map that shows the circuits of travel within the United States, if you have a Southern California-based migrante who by fortune qualifies for Medicaid or CHIP, and that worker moves to Oregon or Washington for some other reason, that person needs to disenroll from Medicaid in California and re-enroll in Medicaid in whatever state of destination that they arrive at. We have a very, very interesting program going on right now in Texas that is addressing that issue as a result of a 10-year legal battle that's called the Frew case. Anybody familiar with that? Sharon, I know you are. This was a lawsuit that was brought by the Texas Rural Legal Services against the state of Texas for failure to provide preventive services to those children who were enrolled in Medicaid. And it was a long and lengthy battle, and as a result of that, we've had several very positive, it's been about a year and a half, I think, since the case was finally resolved. And as a result of that, we've had some very remarkable steps forward, one of which is the increase in providers' reimbursement, which makes it more attractive for them to accept Medicaid and CHIP patients. Another is the fact that the managed care organizations that have farm workers, have migrants enrolled in their care need to identify their migrants. Ironically, they haven't yet been able to do that. They call us periodically because they have a series of reports that are due to demonstrate that they're providing special support systems to their migrant population. And the problem is that they don't know how to ask a patient or ask an enrolled family what their occupational status is. They simply say, "Are you a migrant?" And unfortunately, the family says no. And the reason they say no is because there's a huge stigma, especially in Texas, to be considered a migrant. And if they would learn to ask the question in the right language and with the right cultural sensitivity to ask about your occupation and what you do and do you move around and do you do agricultural work, they can get at the answer. But so far, they haven't learned that lesson. Now, I have about 10 minutes left, or...
That would be good. No more than 10.
Okay, I can do it in less than 10. This is my last section of my presentation. It's an overview of community and migrant health centers in the United States. In 1937, the Farm Security Administration was established, and then they began to provide care through the Farm Security Administration to migrants, and those were largely our domestic migrants. In the 1950s, the Public Health Service established the Migrant Health Unit, and that's where our friend Helen Johnston, who gave us those wonderful pictures, got her start. And then in 1962, the Migrant Health Act was signed, and this was the legislation that created the Migrant Health Program. 5 years later, in 1967, the Community Health Center Act was authorized. And in 1996, both of those programs were consolidated along with the homeless program. So now we have one piece of legislation, not three separate pieces of legislation, which we have benefited from immensely financially. but at the same time we've suffered because of a loss of identity and focus on the migrant health program. We've benefited financially because when we used to have to go to Congress and ask for an increase in funding for the migrant health program, they all assumed it was an immigrant health program. And by God, they didn't really want to do that. So now our small migrant health program lives in the healthy shadow of the larger community health center program. And as that appropriation increases each year, so does the migrant health program. And then in 2001, President Bush adopted what we now call the Presidential Initiative, which is a plan of current administration to expand the community and migrant health center and homeless health center program. So I'm going to talk in particular about migrant health centers for a few minutes. Passed in 1962 under JF Kennedy's administration, and at the same time we had programs that were implemented in education and in labor to provide safety net services to migrant and seasonal agricultural workers. And now here's the rest of the picture in the Vete Sano, Regrese Sano map. These dots represent the location of the consolidated migrant and community and homeless health centers in the United States, and each one of these dots represents the corporate headquarters. They run, on average, 7 health center sites. So you could multiply those dots in those regions by 7. And that means that we have great saturation in certain parts of the country and great gaps in other parts of the country. And unfortunately, some of those areas where gaps exist are areas that are largely largely populated with migrantes who go there to work. For example, if you look in Oklahoma, up in the panhandle area of Oklahoma, there's huge meat processing and dairy operations with very, very limited coverage. Same thing up in the panhandle of Texas. The health center model, private nonprofit corporations, federal funding, which represents 15 to 25% of their budget, a consumer majority of community board of directors members. That's really what sets us aside from the hospital and the county health departments, although some county health departments have gotten waivers and run community health centers. There is a comprehensive team. It's a comprehensive team-managed primary care model. There's emphasis on continuity and case management. We provide culturally and linguistically appropriate care. Health education and prevention services. It is geographically accessible under one roof. And fees are charged in accordance with the income and size of the family, i.e. a sliding fee scale. We have innovative service delivery models that fit the area need. And what I mean by that, for example, for migrant farm workers, is the employment of not only comprehensive migrant health centers or community and migrant health centers, but what we call migrant voucher programs, which may include mobile units that go out into the community, and then coordination of services through a nursing model or a PA, a nurse practitioner model, where you have providers, licensed providers, actually providing care. The bottom photograph there is a mobile unit that I built when I was running migrant health centers in southwestern Michigan back in the 70s and early 80s. Incredible service adaptations, the voucher programs, the mobile units, the use of lay health promoters, outreach programs, family visits, bridge case management to make sure that as people migrate from one place to the other, especially for issues like cancer, pregnancy, HIV/AIDS, very critical. Portable medical record and ID bracelets often provided by our health centers, complementary and alternative medicine, culturally sensitive education for providers, appropriate language and literacy levels for patients, and collaboration with other service providers such as schools and daycare centers. Ah, I was supposed to translate this slide. I'm so sorry. And actually, I think that what we've got listed here is a listing of the types of services, not necessarily the service delivery modality, but care. The first bullet is care for healthy children, adolescent health care, family planning, prenatal care, adult health care, control of chronic disease, care for prevention, dental prevention and emergencies. And I'm embarrassed to say that that's really all we do in dental. It's very, very difficult for us to do restorative care. Oral health is the single greatest disease that we find among the migrante and migrant population. And ironically, it is the single most preventable disease. And we are so overwhelmed with the demand for dental care that we focus on prevention with children and adults, and for adults in particular, we do a lot of emergency care. One of my dental providers came to me one year and said, "Bobby, I feel like I'm going extraction happy." This was a man that I had recruited through the local medical society, and he was not accustomed to having to pull teeth at the rate that he was pulling them. But the best we could do was alleviate the problem. Ambulatory mental health services, x-rays, simple x-rays and lab services, pharmaceutical services, immunizations, and complementary services, including interpretation and transportation. And a note at the bottom that all of the services are offered with a discount to people without insurance and with income less than 200% of poverty. How to find the closest health center? We have several ways of doing that, and for those of you who didn't get my business card, I'll leave this up for a few minutes and let you write that down. For people who did get my business card, this will be in the PowerPoint when I send it to you. And what I probably will do is put this up on a special web page so that you can download it from there, because the text and the graphics and the photographs are so voluminous that I can't email it to you. But if you send me an email, I'll give you the website. And for those of you who may have just walked in and are interested in receiving an electronic copy of this, I'm going to give you my email address. It's very simple. It's my last name, which is Ryder, R-Y-D-E-R, at ncfh.org. Nancy, Charles, Frank, and Harry.org. Okay? Have I put anybody to sleep yet? I don't think so. Okay. We have pocket directories that are available. And then there are a number of organizations very similar to mine that focus on a variety of different support systems. Farmworker Health Services is located both in Washington, D.C. and in the San Francisco Bay Area. Farmworker Justice focuses on I'm going to tell you what they do. Farmworker Health Services focuses on development of outreach programs. Farmworker Justice is in D.C., and it focuses on pesticide issues in particular. Migrant Clinicians Network provides a home, a professional home, for providers who are interested in serving farm workers and migrantes. Migrant Health Promotion is a program that specializes in development of lay health promoter programs. The National Association of Community Health Centers is our trade association, which most of us belong to, and we have them to thank for the presidential initiative, and they have another expansion plan in their hip pocket that they're currently sharing with both of our presidential candidates. My organization, the National Center for Farmworker Health, there it is in writing, www.ncfh.org. And then we have a cluster of seven regional migrant health coordinators. Unfortunately, we don't have any in the Midwest, but in along the Eastern Stream and the Western Stream, we have ombuds people who serve as liaisons to health centers to help them attain their special services for the migrant and migrante population. And I believe that's my last slide. Thank you very much. Can I put that back by going backwards?
I think so.
Let me see. Doesn't seem to work. Okay. Just in case you need a little more time with that one, I'll let you do that. So